You're listening to a Rare Genomics Institute Rare Share podcast. Hi everyone, my name is Romel Mitter, a volunteer at Rare Share and Rare Genomics. I'm your host for today's edition of a podcast series produced by Rare Share. These podcasts are intended to engage and inform the rare disease community with unique stories about rare disease families, patients, and recent developments. RareShare.org is a social networking platform that provides an online forum for those interested in rare diseases, including patients, families, caregivers, researchers, and healthcare professionals who may not otherwise be able to readily connect with each other. RareShare is here to serve you in providing networking opportunities and accurate information on rare diseases. Just a reminder, the content of this podcast is intended for general information purposes only and should not be considered a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Rare diseases occur everywhere, affecting all populations. The Clinic for Special Children in Pennsylvania focuses on serving the needs of the Amish and Mennonite communities. This episode, we will be speaking to three guests from the Clinic for Special Children. Our first guest is Dr. Kevin A. Strauss, the clinic's medical director. Dr. Strauss works to develop and implement strategic goals and objectives that fulfill the clinical, research, and educational missions of the clinic. He is also responsible for overseeing the clinical, research, and laboratory operations of the clinic. Dr. Strauss received his doctorate of medicine from Harvard Medical School. Our next guest is Carla W. Brigati, the clinic's research operations director. In that role, Carla manages and coordinates research projects with collaborators at the clinic. She generates research protocols, ensures proper collection of data samples, and ensures compliance with regulatory requirements. Carla received her Master's of Science in Human Genetics from Sarah Lawrence College. Last but not least, we would like to welcome Dr. Eric Puffenberger, who is the clinic's laboratory director. His work involves the implementation of molecular techniques for routine diagnosis, research into the genetics of isolated populations, development of molecular strategies for newborn screening, and identification of novel disease genes by genetic mapping and exome sequencing. Dr. Puffenberger received his doctorate in human genetics from Case Western Reserve University. Today, I would also like to introduce Bethany Milford of the Rare Share team, who will be interviewing our guests from the Clinic for Special Children. Welcome.
So, could you give us a kind of brief history about the clinic and specifically explain to us just how the clinic was founded?
The clinic was started in 1989 as a nonprofit medical home for Amish and Mennonite children with rare inborn errors of metabolism, genetic inborn errors of metabolism. And it was really started by Dr. Holmes Morton and his wife Caroline, with the help of some leaders within the community, within the Amish and Mennonite community, who had children affected with these disorders. And at the time, Dr. Morton was working as a metabolic genetics fellow, initially at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia and then later at Johns Hopkins, and was the first person to recognize that there was a fairly large number of Amish children in Lancaster County who had been given the diagnosis of cerebral palsy, but in fact turned out to have a rare metabolic disorder called glutaric aciduria type 1. And Dr. Morton realized that if there was going to be any progress in diagnosing this disorder early and developing successful treatment, it would require doing more aggressive testing of newborns and also creating affordable and accessible medical services in Lancaster County. And so through a series of steps and decisions, they set up a small practice here, originally a one-physician practice, with a CLIA certified laboratory to do the chemical diagnostics here and also provide medical care for these children. And it really was, the idea was, if you really wanted to have an impact in an underserved community like this, you had to sort of take the services where they were needed rather than expect families to travel into the city with their limited resources. And that was really the kind of the inception of the clinic. I think at the time, there was a pretty intense focus on glutaric aciduria, maple syrup urine disease, which is another very common metabolic disorder in the Mennonites, and really just a handful of other what we call inborn errors of metabolism. But of course, what has happened over our more than 30-year history is the scope of work here has really greatly expanded now to include diagnosis and treatment now of over 400 different genetic disorders with a range of manifestations across organ systems, chronic liver diseases, neuromuscular disorders, bone dysplasias, epilepsies, forms of intellectual disability. And of course, the capabilities of the laboratory have expanded greatly in parallel to that. Dr. Morton originally was doing just what we would call analytical chemistry in the lab, doing diagnosis with simple blood and urine chemical tests for different amino acids and organic acids. And then when Dr. Puffenberger came in 1998, he really started the molecular laboratory, and that has, the capabilities of the molecular laboratory have just really greatly grown in scope and complexity over his tenure here. I'm sure he can talk more about that.
And in your few words, could you describe to us or define what the primary mission of the clinic is?
I mean, I think the primary mission is to alleviate suffering to the extent that we can for children and adults who are sort of victims of biological chance. These are people, you know, born with these really often debilitating conditions through no fault of their own. And, you know, we have an opportunity through early diagnosis and very intentional treatment protocols to, in many cases, prevent untimely death, to prevent neurological disability, you know, motor impairments, cognitive impairments. And I think that really is sort of central to the mission to, I guess the way we say it here, to treat the right child with the right therapy at the right time. And the only way to do that is to embed yourself in the community like this and sort of become part of the, you know, part of the community in a way. I think one of the reasons we've been able to do what we have over the years is that we have really formed an effective partnership with the community. I think that the Amish and Mennonite people have a real sense of ownership in this clinic. They support us financially. They raise very significant charitable funds that help support our operating costs each year through charitable quilt auctions, anonymous donations. And they've literally physically built the building with their own hands. They raised the timbers that hold our roof on here. And so I think that has established this very deep foundation of trust that has given us a lot of traction in pushing innovative therapies in a way that would actually be difficult in many academic settings.
Now, for our listeners, could you please provide a brief history of the Amish and Mennonite communities? Specifically, you know, how are they impacted by these specific rare disorders? And, you know, what approaches has your clinic adopted to address these rare diseases?
The Amish and Mennonites are a sort of isolated founder populations that arrived in Lancaster County in the 1700s in multiple migrations. They are related socially, so they're Anabaptists, and so this was part of the Protestant Reformation, and then around in 1525, the Anabaptists sort of broke off and formed their own separate group. At that time, they were called the Swiss Mennonites, so they were sort of all one group. And then in the late 1600s, the Amish broke off and sort of formed their own group. And then the individuals from these two groups then began to migrate here to Lancaster County at the urging of William Penn to populate, you know, the areas west of Philadelphia. And our populations today, the Old Order Mennonites and the Old Order Amish, are descended from those original founding individuals. And the founding groups were actually relatively small. It's estimated that maybe there were effectively about 100 couples, Amish couples, and maybe about 250 Mennonites. So these founding groups were quite tiny, and they married within the group. They stayed within their group. And so what we see today is certain disorders that are at a higher frequency in these populations that are globally rare. So if we take an example like maple syrup urine disease, which is quite common in the Mennonites, the incidence of that disease in Europe, in say the Swiss population, is maybe 1 in 200,000 children. Here in Lancaster County, among the Mennonites, it's about 1 in 400. So we are orders of magnitude more common. And that's simply because, you know, in one of those 250 founders, one of them happened to be a carrier for maple syrup urine disease. And then through a process called genetic drift, the allele frequency, or that particular change that caused maple syrup urine disease, increased in frequency within the population. And so we see just a relatively small number of disorders that are rare globally that have increased in frequency in these isolated populations. Notably, there are plenty of diseases, recessive genetic diseases like cystic fibrosis, that we don't see here. And given the population sizes, we expect to see those diseases here. But the founding population, no one was a carrier in those founding populations. So there's disorders that we don't see. So we have a very unique genetic heritage here and a very unique set of genetic diseases that we see. That actually is very helpful, both genetically and clinically, to learn and to know what the genetic background is of the populations. And that's a lot of the work that I have done since I came back in 1998, was to sort of build upon the very beginnings of sort of the molecular diagnoses that we were making at the time. Of course, then we only knew of a handful of mutations that segregated in the population. And today we, as Kevin said, we have hundreds of them.
And it's kind of it's a common misconception that many people have that isolated populations like this, or reproductively isolated populations, are sort of riven with genetic disorders. And that's not exactly accurate. We don't have good evidence to suggest one way or the other if Amish and Mennonite populations have a higher overall burden of genetic illness. But genetic disorders are distributed differently. There's sort of different levels of enrichment for certain genes, as Eric pointed out. And what this allows us to do through Eric's work in the lab and through linking that very directly to clinical services is it's a lever to really optimize prevention strategies, because we've really been able to characterize what we would call the kind of pathogenic genetic architecture of the population, and can anticipate health risks long before they cause disease in patients. So by knowing what the landscape of different, what we call pathogenic alleles or genetic risk factors in the population, is we can actually develop systematic screening strategies. I often identify couples who are at high risk for having one or another genetic children with one or another genetic disorder, then diagnose those disorders in newborn babies using umbilical cord blood within a couple of hours of life, and then in the best case scenario, apply protective therapies that can safeguard that child's well-being. And so it really is a way, the way I often talk about it is combining the genetics with the clinical service allows us to practice what I would call proactive rather than reactive medicine. So most medicine is practiced reactively. And what I mean by that is you wait until you're sick and then you go to see your doctor. You wait till you have a stroke, or you wait till you have a heart attack, or wait till your child has a seizure. And that usually is what initiates medical intervention. That's reactive medicine. And it's kind of embodied in this idea that you have to, the first thing in the medical chart is the chief complaint. You have to be complaining of something to see a doctor. You know, I think here we take a very proactive stance. We would much prefer to identify genetic risks before they cause disease and then leverage preventative strategies. And, you know, one of the really exciting things that has happened here in recent years through a convergence of, you know, a lot of exome sequencing we've done here and you know, the advent of new next generation sequencing technologies is we've developed something called the Plain Insight Panel, or the PIP, which really takes this approach to the next level. Maybe Carla, maybe you could talk a little bit about the PIP.
Yeah, the PIP was one of the really exciting sort of products of all of the work that Dr. Puffenberger and others at the clinic have really done to sort of understand the genetic underpinnings of disease here. And in one test, we can include over 1,300 pathogenic or likely pathogenic variants that we either know are clearly associated with disease or seen in patients that we treat here, or that we suspect may be associated with disease based on their predicted effect on the gene's function, or on the fact that it's been reported in other populations as associated with disease. And so when we sort of developed the PIP, we were really curious how the community would take to it. How would they receive this? How would they use this information? And it's just been a wonderful journey of discovery for us and a really wonderful partnership with the communities that we serve and for other healthcare providers who care for the same patients that we do as well. So when we launched the PIP, we were really curious as to how it would be received by the community. How would they use this test and, you know, within their own selves, for their families and for the larger community? And what we found is that they embraced the test in multiple ways. So couples were really interested in finding out about their shared genetic risk, so it could inform what they needed to know for their own childbearing and be prepared for, you know, children who may be at risk for genetic diseases captured on the test. We also found that older individuals were interested in doing the PIP just to learn about their own sort of genetic lineage, so to speak, and because the PIP does include certain variants that have sort of personalized or personal implications for health and well-being and so forth. And then we also found a number of parents utilized the test when they sort of came to the clinic here in Strasbourg or one of our sister clinics throughout the United States. And they were looking for a diagnosis for their child and didn't have one. So the PIP could be used for the parents to be tested, find out if they were carriers in common for any specific variants or a gene. And then if they were, and it was a specific characteristics that fit the problems that we saw with the child presenting for care, we could then test the child in a targeted fashion and make that diagnosis that way. So it was really, I like to think of the PIP as sort of a Swiss Army knife of tests, where it's one test but has multiple uses and utilities, depending on who's doing the test, if you will.
And I'll add just a little bit to that to underscore that, you know, this is sort of the culmination of of our, you know, long history of accumulating knowledge about variants that segregate in these populations. And so we've long wanted a laboratory test that we could use and implement that would allow us to cover all of the known susceptibility variants in the population. And we were, you know, finally able to get this panel together. We had tried well over 5 years ago to design a panel that would work. And we tried two different methodologies and they just weren't quite up to snuff. We finally got hooked up with some collaborators at AI DuPont Hospital for Children, who helped us, connected us with a company out in Colorado that allowed us to develop this panel. And it really works quite well. And I think one of the things that's really interesting about it is that we use it really for expanded carrier screening, not necessarily newborn screening. And so that's also different. And it's a way that that we have used the lab over the years. And that is to bring testing in-house that we can't get done cheaply or rapidly anywhere else. And so we try and bring those tests in-house, develop a rapid assay and one that will be cheaper than what we can get done somewhere at another lab. So in a sense, our laboratory here in the clinic, which is unusual, is really a core laboratory. Our laboratory here serves the clinicians and, you know, gets answers and does rapid testing and inexpensive testing on our patients. We're not sort of a send out laboratory like Mayo or any other, you know, or any of the other large laboratories. And so this really has been something, a guiding principle of the laboratory, is to bring things in that we can do rapidly and we can do inexpensively.
I think that can be said really in general of all of the services here, is that they really have over the years consistently been shaped around and tailored to the most pressing needs of the community. So, you know, when I finished my pediatrics training 20 years ago, I never imagined I'd be treating neuromuscular disorders and epilepsies and bone dysplasias and just the large diversity of problems that we see here. But the reason why I'm doing that is that's what the community needs me to do. In the same way, the community needed Dr. Puffenberger to develop these precision instruments for testing because it's the right thing to do, to leverage the full power of the Human Genome Project for improving people's health. And it's sort of interesting, ironic that, you know, we're working out here in a cornfield with a community of people who historically have been suspicious of technological advancement in general. And they are really in many ways at the point of the spear for how genomic medicine should be practiced. You know, really show they were really a, you know, sort of pioneering the way forward for how we utilize this kind of preventative genetic information. And the PIP is a wonderful example of that. Even the fact that we use it for expanded carrier testing is a different sort of paradigm. You've probably heard about or read about this rapid whole genome or whole exome sequencing done on sick newborn babies. This was work pioneered by Dr. Kingsmore, I believe, in California, and now it's being done multiple tertiary care centers. But again, that's a reactive model. It's waiting till you have sick babies in the intensive care unit and then, you know, running these very expensive, complicated tests to try to understand what's wrong with them. And so what we're really doing is doing a much more affordable, accessible test in young couples to predict whether or not they are at risk for having children with these dangerous conditions, and being able to sit down with well in advance of them having those children and talk to them about treatment options and take full advantage of new platforms like gene therapy and preventative cell therapies. And this is something that I hope you'll see more of in general clinical practice, but it's something that we have, I think, really been able to do exceedingly well here through the cooperation of the community. And one of the other interesting things about the Amish and Mennonite people we work with is, even though they in general are suspicious of technologies, particularly technologies that erode social interdependence, they are very interested in the technologies we develop here, very engaged with it, and generally embrace it because they're highly pragmatic people. So they see the value in the PIP. They see what it means for the health of their children and their communities. And they don't need any convincing. It's a very interesting how amenable our patients are to deploying these technologies.
Everything you've just said is extremely interesting and also just very promising. It definitely sounds like you're finding very innovative solutions, and everything is very tailored to the community concerned. You know, even though many of these challenges are being addressed, what are some of the challenges that you have faced and that you might currently be facing?
One that is a really, I think, a challenge for all of us, but we're faced with it in a very practical way on a daily basis, and that is the sort of extraordinary costs of a lot of these technologies. And you know, these technologies tend to sharpen social inequities. They tend to make it more clear who the have and have nots are in a society, in any society. And the Amish and Mennonite people are conscientious objectors to Social Security and health insurance, and they're actually uninsurable under federal law if they have what's called a 4029 tax exemption. And when you're working with a self-pay population who's shouldering a big burden of genetic disorders, you realize very quickly what the exorbitant costs are of delivering modern healthcare and doing this kind of testing. And so that has been a perennial challenge for us here. We have constantly had to create accessibility strategies for patients, not only with regard to diagnostic testing. Dr. Puffenberger has developed a lot of very innovative ways to do tests inexpensively and rapidly, but also with therapies, negotiating with hospitals, negotiating with pharmaceutical companies for fair pricing and accessible access to therapeutics. And you really realize very quickly why it is so difficult for people without health insurance or who are underinsured to get anything like standard of care for serious medical conditions.
The other thing I would add to that is that a challenge for us, and that's really sort of not unique to the clinic, but one that's shared among those who care for rare disease and ultra-rare disease, is that developing a therapy that's, you know, disease-modifying therapies for rare disease is extraordinarily expensive and difficult to do. And so we really feel an important part of our responsibility is to advocate for developing these therapies, to be a voice for the community and see what we can do in partnership with the community and potentially industry, advocacy, academia, to really find ways to push new and innovative approaches to finding therapies that work for these rare disorders that are, you know, much more common potentially in our own community of patients here. And so we've really been very conscious about gathering natural history data prospectively in patients who have certain rare disorders that we see commonly here at the Clinic for Special Children, and working with that community of patients to make them, see the value of clinical trials and therapeutic development and what those steps may be. So it's an education process and a partnership for us and for them, and for collaborators that we may be seeking and working with as well outside of the clinic specifically.
Yeah, I'll just echo as one example. We've talked about the Plain Insight panel here. Our costs in the lab to run that panel on a single sample are about $500. The charge that we pass on to patients is $99. So we have to make up that other $401 somewhere. As a nonprofit, we basically solicit funds to try and offset the costs of those tests that we run. But that's how strongly we feel about these, these are very important tests. These provide a great service for the community, help the clinicians here prepare for the birth of an affected child in the future. And so we just feel very strongly about it. And I would say probably one of the other challenges, and I know Carla is probably a challenge for you as well, coming from doing genetic counseling, elsewhere, is that the populations here basically have an eighth grade education. So sort of educating the community requires a certain skill set to be able to talk to people and in a very down to earth, straightforward way, using as little jargon as possible. Can actually really be challenging. It can be a lot of fun, but it certainly is quite a challenge at times. And I'm sure Carla could tell you a little bit about that as well.
No, it's true. It's true. Sort of breaking things down. I will say that the communities we work with are very genetically savvy in the sense that they understand their own family history and what risks. They're wonderful historians in a way. And because they're so sort of community oriented, they're very interested in sharing their findings with other members of the community and with the world at large. So, when we publish something on a new gene disease association, my families here are thrilled that there is a family in Israel or Belgium or Mexico that sort of maybe shares a different variant in the same gene, and that they sort of have these experiences that can be important and informative for others around the world. For those disorders that have really important neonatal implications, I think Dr. Sarasaly said it well, that we want to know who the parents are, who the carriers are, who's at risk for these children. And by really informing them of options, therapeutic options, before they have a child who's in the NICU or it has had an expensive workup that we could have found the answer relatively quickly here in our laboratory and so forth, it really just sets the stage for the best outcomes once a baby is born and diagnosed. So for children with maple syrup urine disease, our lab is able to make that diagnosis the first day of life. Newborn screening results don't come back until day 7 sometimes, which can be devastating. Spinal muscular atrophy, the same story there. By talking to couples while they're pregnant or even before they're pregnant about the possibility of having a child with this condition, they are very well informed about what therapeutic options they may have and what process they want to follow to treat after their baby is born. So it is much less of a stressful, emergent, all hands on deck type of approach needed with this proactive versus reactive approach.
I'll tell you an interesting anecdote about that with maple syrup urine disease, which I think speaks volumes to this approach. So a number of years ago, there was a state audit in the state of Pennsylvania looking at all of the different disorders that were picked up by the newborn screening program in the state. So maple syrup urine disease is one of a number of inborn errors of metabolism that all babies in Pennsylvania are screened for at birth on what's called the filter paper card or the Guthrie card. And when we talked to the state health department, we knew that they were underestimating the number of MSUD babies born in the state by at least half, because they reported back to us so many cases, and we knew of twice that number just in the Mennonites alone. And of course, the answer to the puzzle was that we had diagnosed babies so quickly as newborns and got them on treatment at home so effectively that they never got sick and their newborn screening tests were normal. So children with maple syrup urine disease, half of the children born in the state had a normal newborn screening test because they were treated so quickly, which would have just been completely unheard of in almost any other community. And half of the children with MSUD born here over the last 15 years have never been to the hospital, which is an extraordinary statistic. And that's kind of the power of just foresight, really. What we do for maple syrup urine disease isn't really much different than what is done at other major academic centers, but it's deployed in a way that is so patient-centered and so efficient that it really does prevent a lot of downstream complications.
For our listeners, would you mind kind of briefly explaining maple syrup urine disease a little further?
One of the most complicated inborn errors in metabolism, but fundamentally what maple syrup urine disease is it's a recessive disorder that results from having two mutations in one of three different genes. These genes work together to degrade three protein components called amino acids. So we eat protein in our diet, and protein is used as sort of the bricks and mortar to build tissues in your body. And proteins themselves are made up of building blocks called amino acids. And there's 20 or so amino acids in nature. And those, you can think of them kind of like Lego pieces to make up protein. And of the 20, there are three of them, leucine, isoleucine, and valine, called the branch chain amino acids, that are all broken down by a common enzyme complex that is distributed in tissues throughout the body. And so any protein that your body takes in excess of the minimal amount needed for growth is degraded. The amino acids are degraded and used as energy. Patients with maple syrup urine disease have a block in that pathway. So if they take any protein in excess of the minimal requirement the body needs, these amino acids build up in the bloodstream and the tissues. And one of them in particular is poisonous to the brain. When it reaches very high levels, it causes what we call encephalopathy, which is a kind of delirium. Patients become very sleepy. They lose their balance. They start to hallucinate. And as that process unfolds, the brain becomes swollen and becomes so swollen that without treatment, without very careful treatment, they develop critical pressure in the brain that's ultimately fatal, cause severe brain damage like strokes. And so the treatment is really a combination of a special diet on a day-to-day basis that it uses these synthetic, what we call synthetic medical foods. These are specially engineered baby formulas, essentially, and formulas for older children and adults that are devoid of the amino acids the body can't degrade properly. And these patients can only tolerate about 10% of the normal protein intake that you and I eat in a day. What they'll tell you is it's about they can have the amount of protein that's in about one medium McDonald's French fry or a McDonald's French fries. And that's about all the natural protein they can eat each day. The rest of their diet comes from this synthetic liquid formula. And so we have a long history diagnosing and treating maple syrup urine disease. And we have designed some of the formulas that are currently used. The other pillar of the therapy is a very complex hospital protocol for treatment of brain swelling and coma that I will not go into here because it is complicated and it's quite dangerous. But we've also here been able to pioneer some novel therapies for MSUD, namely liver transplantation. So in 2003, we started a program with the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center to apply elective liver transplantation, and it works effectively as a cure for the disease. It doesn't correct all complications, and it entails its own sorts of morbidities, but it is a highly effective therapy. And currently, we're actually working with collaborators to try to develop a gene therapy for maple syrup urine disease.
you know, kind of going into some of the most prevalent diseases, I imagine that definitely does involve a lot of education and translating, because obviously some of these conditions are extremely complex. And I was wondering if, I know you touched on a few rare diseases, but could you elaborate on some of the most prevalent rare diseases in the community? And
among the Amish, we have a number of diseases that we see quite commonly. Dr. Strauss mentioned glutaric aciduria type 1, which was the one that really sort of got the clinic started by Dr. Morton over 30 years ago. But within the Amish population, there are a number of other disorders like Ellis-Van Creveld syndrome, Cusick-Kaufman syndrome, familial hypercholinemia, that are all very high. The frequency of the mutation in the population, or said another way, the carrier frequency in the population, the number of carriers in the population, is quite high for those disorders. And these are particular variants, DNA variants, that were carried over by a founder and have drifted to a rather high frequency in the population. And as such, they cause a good deal of disease in the population here. Among the Mennonites, maple syrup urine disease is clearly the most common disorder that we see. But we also have a Wardenberg syndrome that is pretty common, and we also see a good bit of cystinuria, different mutations in two different genes that cause cystinuria. Also, we have a form of congenital nephrotic syndrome, again, that's quite common. And so we can actually list these, variants by their frequency in the population. Some of the things we see are actually no more common here than they are in the general population. But some of them, like the ones that I just mentioned, are at actually much higher frequency, orders of magnitude higher frequency here. And I would say we have seen probably over 150 children with MSUD, with maple syrup urine disease, in the Mennonite community. 184, yeah. So it's one of the diseases that we see very, very frequently here.
Spinal muscular atrophy is another one that is very common. We see it both in the Amish and Mennonite. It's quite common in the Mennonite population, especially. That disease has drawn a lot of attention lately because it is the one of the first diseases to be an indication for now three different disease-modifying therapies approved by the FDA, and one of the first systemically delivered gene therapies. And it's about 3 to 4 times more common in the Mennonites, but worldwide it is often cited as being the most common genetic form of infant death. Occurs in about 1 in 10,000 to 1 in 12,000 babies worldwide. And it causes spinal cord degeneration very early in life that begins actually probably prenatally and progresses rapidly over the first 3 months of life and leaves children, completely helpless, essentially hypotonic and paralyzed, and leads to respiratory failure, uniformly fatal by age 2, or ventilator dependence or fatality by age 2. And now there's, these new precision therapies for SMA. And, we've been able, because we have, very rapid and affordable testing, we have a very sound knowledge of who the carriers are in the population and where they live. We know them personally and have developed a good rapport with many of the carrier couples. We're able to diagnose those babies within a few hours of life, usually less than 24 hours of age, and get them access to these really life-changing therapies in the first week of life. And now children who would have uniformly died of these diseases just a few years ago are thriving. Many of them are sitting and walking. And this is the kind of thing that can be accomplished in in a community like this and really kind of underscores, I think, in a more specific way, the concept of access. You know, people often talk about access to care and don't often talk about what that means specifically. It's a popular thing to say, we want to make care more accessible, but what does that actually mean? You know, access is about place, time, and money. It's about all those things. You have to have services where they're needed. You have to be embedded in the place where the services is needed. So you can't always expect people to come to you for help, right? We sort of that's a cornerstone of what this place is about. We took very high level of knowledge and expertise out of the university into the neighborhood where people needed it. It's about time. So many of the therapies that we have to offer to patients with genetic disease don't work if you wait until people get sick, if you wait until they have brain damage, if you wait until they have liver failure or heart failure. You've lost that window of opportunity of accessing, a healthy child and making an intervention that actually can lead to prevention. So that's another part of it. And then it's about money. And a lot of people, unfortunately, not just Amish and Mennonite people, but a lot of people simply cannot afford, or their insurance will not reimburse for many of these life-changing therapies because of their extraordinary expense. And I think that's something that we have really worked very hard to create access pipelines for our patients. So I think that, you know, these disorders, although they are common in these populations, we often can really make significant inroads into reducing morbidity and mortality from them. Not all of them. And I think the ones that we can't, we know are our priorities for future studies. They're the ones that still keep us awake at night, and we're still looking for new solutions.
Thank you. No, that was great. And actually, you know, on the subject of current innovations, could you explain to listeners what are some of the clinic's future plans? Or is there anything in particular that is kind of at the top of the agenda, or anything that you'd like to underscore?
Well, one of the things that 30 years treating children has done is that a lot of those children are now adults with unique medical needs associated with their condition and so forth. So, you know, we began as a pediatric practice, but we've expanded into adult medicine because that's what we need to do. Again, it's sort of a sign of success in some senses that these children are now living into adulthood and have adult needs that need to be managed as well. And so, you know, the clinic began with one physician and now we have four. And the last physician hired happens to be a family medicine physician because we recognize the need for expanding our scope of practice, if you will.
Yeah, and I think two other really important areas are, you know, we have always here cared for children who need palliative care at home. So some percentage of the diagnoses that we make here are diseases that are have a very grave prognosis early in life, and some fatal muscle disorders and brain disorders. For which we have no disease-modifying therapies. And so in recent years, we've really developed a very comprehensive palliative care program, pediatric palliative care program for those children called the Cherish Lives Program. We're able to provide free health care and palliative care for those children in their home environment. And it's amazing how, you know, with all the technology, sometimes the best gift a technology can give us is tell us what not to do. An example of that is, you know, we take care of a number of these lethal genetic disorders that we're able to diagnose within 1 or 2 days of life. And and explain to parents the limits of what healthcare can do and provide for humane and thoughtful care at home and protect children from the hospital, you know, to protect them from futile interventions, painful interventions, extending helpless lives indefinitely on home ventilators and these things. These are not things that are, you know, within the value system of the Amish and Mennonite people. And so, you know, sometimes the greatest service we can do for them is to keep them out of the hospital. And so this is another important way to utilize genetic information that people often underestimate, I think. And I think another thing that we're really excited about in years ahead is these are some of the very same disorders that are inspiring us to really develop some hopefully new precision therapies that could be life-changing. You know, one of the disorders that is one of the most common diagnoses on our palliative care service is a disorder called troponin myopathy. And it's a lethal form of infantile onset muscle disease that causes death or permanent ventilation by 5 years of age uniformly. And it puts big demands on our palliative care service, but it is also one of our top priorities for developing a gene therapy, because we really believe that this is a disorder that, like SMA, will be amenable to these new gene therapy platforms. And so I think that's another interesting thing about this place is a theme that keeps coming up is these sorts of problems that come through our door every day really define the future of the clinic. It's probably an exercise in futility to try to predict what we'll be doing 5 years from now, even next week. You know, we really don't have the luxury of choosing what we're going to study or what we're going to do. We just look at the problems that confront us in the waiting room every day and figure out the best ways to try to solve them.
We are really interested in bringing more next generation sequencing into the lab. The reason for that really is that we do a lot of diagnostic work, but we have a very high solve rate for our cases, probably pushing 75% of our patients who walk through the door get a genetic diagnosis, but we still have 25% of our patients who come and we do not have a diagnosis for them. We are still searching. And so the tools that we've been using have gotten us to this point, but we're hoping that something like whole genome sequencing in the future and maybe some of even the multi-omics type studies will be able to get us closer to 100% for genetic diagnoses for our patients. And that's really what the lab will be working on in the next 5 or 10 years.
Really exciting stuff ahead, definitely. And sounds like every week there's potential for something new and something to learn. In what ways or how does the clinic serve rare disease patients outside of the Amish and Mennonite communities in your area?
Yeah, we do. About 15% of our patients are from outside the Plain communities. And the majority of them are people who have a disorder, a genetic disorder, for which we have considerable expertise because of working with the Plain population. So maple syrup urine disease and glutaric aciduria are common examples of that, where because of our founder mutations here, we have such an overwhelmingly large experience with those disorders compared to pretty much every other academic center in the world that we attract patients with those disorders from all over the world. And that includes, in some cases, people who have moved here from places like Iran and Brazil and the Ukraine and India to specifically get care here. And that also includes for patients who have not moved. Increasingly, it includes some teleconferencing and, you know, telemedicine internationally. And then there are occasionally patients who have been to academic medical centers. They're not in the Plain community, and they're dissatisfied, and they believe that we might be able to offer them some additional insight in way of diagnostics or some special approach to therapy, and they want to explore that. There's fewer of those patients because we are a self-pay clinic. We don't work with insurance companies here, so oftentimes that discourages people from coming who have insurance.
Where can listeners learn more about the clinic? What are some ways that they can get involved, even if any?
Well, our website, www.clinicforspecialchildren.org, is regularly, our communications manager puts up new updates on things that we're up to and events that we're hosting for the community, both the Plain community and the community at large. So there are lots of opportunities there. Our social media feed, we have an active presence on Facebook and Instagram. Those are always good ways to find out what's happening there. And on the website, there are ways to contact us as well with specific questions or opportunities for student learning and rotations here for researchers and clinicians alike. So, I think there's lots of ways to sort of learn about what we're doing.
Yeah, there's a YouTube clinic YouTube channel that has a number of videos. There's a TED Talk that I gave a number of years ago that is, I think it's a nice overview. It talks a lot about the origins of the clinic, and there's some history of the Anabaptist people in there. Our new clinical operations director, Dr. Vincent Carson, just did a TED Talk just a couple of weeks ago, which is really excellent. It's about kind of the power of a genetic diagnosis in the lives of individuals. He did a really lovely job with that. People want to get into take a deeper dive. We have over the years published, quite a number of peer-reviewed publications. Many of those are freely available. We try to pay for open access publishing licenses on those papers so that we can democratize the knowledge as much as possible. So I encourage people to scan the scholarly literature for some of those resources. That also includes, some of those papers include more like general reviews that cover a lot of the information you heard here. And if people want to help, really, please feel free to donate to the cause. We are a real nonprofit mission. Every dollar we spend directly on diagnostics or patient care or research related to trying to solve these diseases. And, every dollar counts. And so if you're moved to contribute, we certainly would be grateful for any financial help as well. If you want to do that in a way that's a lot of fun, we have charitable quilt auctions. They've been a little bit thwarted by COVID, but they are coming back now. We have 6 auctions a year. And these are really fun. There's several in Pennsylvania. There's one in Ohio, one in Missouri. These are, in some cases, very large quilt sales and farm goods sales.
Lots of good food.
Lots of good food. And those quilt auctions collectively raise somewhere between 25 and 30% of our operating budget every year. So quite substantial. So we'd encourage you, our website will always have the information about the auctions, and we'd encourage people to look at that. And if you have the wherewithal, then please come join us at an auction.
Yeah, thank you all for your time today. This has been incredibly interesting, insightful, and definitely just very, very helpful. I always find these podcast episodes to be extremely educational, and it's just, yeah, it's been really great talking to you all. So thank you so much for your time.
Thanks to the Clinic for Special Children and Bethany for sharing such a candid and thought-provoking discussion. My name is Shreya Sivakumar, and I am a RareShare volunteer. This has been a fascinating story about how a truly special clinic can have such a significant impact in improving the lives of rare disease patients and advancing research. We hope that this presentation has been informative and provided a hopeful model for dealing with rare diseases. The Clinic for Special Children, staffed by knowledgeable experts located in proximity to a patient population in need, is vital to having access to some of the most current diagnostic and therapeutic tools. CSC has proven to be invaluable in serving its local community. RareShare is part of the nonprofit Rare Genomics Institute. To learn more about the organization and to support our efforts, please visit our website at rareshare.org. If you have an interest in a specific rare disease, please consider joining or starting a community on RareShare. Thank you for listening, and good health to you all.